둘, 셋, 파!
For Hey Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
To find out what's really going on behind the music, sometimes you have to dig deep. I'm Dr. Mike, and on the new season of Going There, we're doing just that.
Art or music can be your escape and your therapy.
Going There is the podcast at the crossroads of music and mental health, where we have raw, meaningful conversations with artists like Noah Kahan, Julian Baker, Jason Isbell, Youngblood, The Head and the Heart, and Bishop Briggs.
I recently heard someone describe grief as glitter, where you'll clean it up and then you'll find little pieces.
By opening ourselves up to these real discussions about mental health, we can foster understanding and gain even greater appreciation for the music we all love.
For me, like, my favorite songs give me happy tears.
So join me and some of your favorite artists on the new season of Going There with Dr. Mike, brought to you by SoundMind Live and the Consequence Podcast Network. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
The Star Wars universe is constantly expanding.
But how the heck are you going to keep tabs on it without a holocron? And where in the rim can I score the juiciest news and rumors?
Ah, you seek State of the Empire, Consequence of Sound's Star Wars speculation podcast, where we look for news in Alderaan places.
We dig into the Sarlacc pit of the internet for the hottest intel in the galaxy far, far away. Make Indiana Jones inquiries and keep watch for the latest on Willow.
Find us on consequenceofsound.net or wherever you procure fine podcasts. It's the show you're looking for. Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith with an audio interview series presented by WFPK Independent Louisville at WFPK.org. Consequence of Sound and the Consequence Podcast Network. Take a second before we get started to hit the subscribe button. We put out interviews every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at Consequence of Sound, and we'd love to keep you up to date. That means whether you're getting your podcast from iTunes and Apple Podcasts, or maybe you're listening on YouTube or Spotify, really wherever you get your podcast from, hit the subscribe button and keep up to date with us. I'm Kyle Meredith. Today I'm taking a 40-year-long journey with Jim Kerr of Simple Minds. We're going to head back to 1979 for the 40th anniversary of their first two records, Life in a Day and Reel to Reel Cacophony. Then we'll jump to 1989 for the Street Fightin' Years, which takes us into 1999 for a lost record called Our Secrets Are the Same and even 09's Graffiti Soul. As it turns out, he's also born on a 9, so it's all around us on this one. We're going to get into the stories of each record, and we'll get an update on what's next. There's lots to get into, so I'm just going to go ahead and turn it over. It's Kyle Meredith with Simple Minds.
How you doing, Kyle?
What we're looking here is a 40-year quest in hopefully less than a half an hour. So,
okay.
But as it happens, I mean, Simple Minds, you released a lot of things on the nines, as it were, you know, 79, 89, and et cetera. And we'll go right back to the beginning, too, because two records in 1979, the first two, Life in a Day and the Reel to Reel record. I mean, this is the 40th anniversary. That's something, right?
Well, you just pointed something out to me, Kyle, about all the nines. I was born on a 59. So.
Oh, wow.
That's the first nine. but that didn't dawn on me until you just said that right there. So the big year for me coming up this year. But that's the irony, you know. I mean, in terms of attitudes toward anniversaries and things, I'm a guy that normally doesn't even celebrate my own birthday, you know. I don't really care about it. However, as a music fan, and that's what is interesting, not even as an artist, but as a music fan, I still do. remember the date of my first concert, and I still do remember certain things that all these years later to do with my love for buying records and seeing live bands.
I mean, that's the great thing. I mean, when you get into the science of music and what it does to your brain, how it just time stamps you in this very specific moment throughout your life, you know, and and of course, you know, and I'll pay you that compliment. I mean, I wasn't around yet in 79, but a lot of your music has done that for me. I came just 2 years later for myself in 81.
All right. But you're one of the babies.
One of the babies. That's right. Baby at 37 now, I suppose. But
cool.
So life in a day. You know, here's where it sort of starts. You know, a couple years into the band's career, you get your first album, and you know, from how I read history and everything, I mean, everything sort of happens really quickly here. I mean, in the UK, this is sort of a hit right out of the gate, right?
Well, it is in the sense that it, much more than we could ever have imagined. But we were either very lucky, very good, or combination of a few things. But certainly, when we started our band, our first gig was in January 78. And within a year, we had signed a record deal and we had played a lot in Scotland. We hadn't really played in England, but we had played a lot in Scotland and had built up quite a local following. Big enough, you know, not huge, but big enough so that when our debut album came out, Life in a Day, there was a lot of people in Scotland waiting for it. And they bought it, which put it into the British charts. This made us look bigger than we were in England off the bat. But yeah, within a year, we kind of, not only did we get a record deal and make a record within a year, you know, secured a spot on national TV on the Sirius Music program, stuff that normally would take people 2, 3, 4 years to do, we had got this momentum behind us, and you're right when you say it went very fast.
How were the first days in the studio for you then? Because, you know, again, for having been sort of so new and it's still in a, you know, constant state of flux as far as putting the band together, what were those first days in that studio like?
I mean, tremendously exciting, kind of overwhelming, but tremendously exciting because some of the band had never been in London. I mean, I had traveled to London, hitchhiked to London with our demo tapes and stuff to go around. But I mean, everything was brand new. We couldn't have been greener, but thought we knew it all. So to go down to, you know, to go into, on that debut album, we worked in the best of two or three places in London, all the state of the art at the time, and including, I mean, the cherry in the cake in terms of being overwhelmed was we even had a week in Abbey Road and all of that, which was, you know, beyond dreams. It was tremendously exciting, but it was also, when I say overwhelming, thinking about it now with hindsight, was it the right thing to do? I'm not so sure it was. It was a huge jump. And to be really honest, some of our demo tapes recorded in the little studio along the road from us in Glasgow had a better feel about them. But that's what it was. We wanted a big produced record, and we wanted to work with a big famous record producer, and we wanted to work in the big studios, and we got what we wanted.
And what you all were doing, I mean, sound-wise, it was starting to erupt, you know, whatever subgenre you want to put that in, as everything's been stamped these days. But everything was still sort of new, what you were doing. And that's what I love about it, you know, in a post-punk angular world. I mean, this was still virgin territory of how to deconstruct and rebuild a song. I mean, I know you all were looking at certain influences that have been talked about, whether it be Roxy or Bowie or The Doors or something like that. But to me, it seems like even touching on those artists, it was still just going out into the darkness with your songwriting. Like, how did you all find that?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I was actually talking today to my songwriting partner, Charlie Burchill, who something came up, and I was saying how we were influenced by very many people, and you just mentioned some of them there. But we weren't very good at copying them. Some people come alive and you can hear, you say, well, that's, you know, that's great, but it's a complete ripoff of something else that came before. We were strongly influenced, but we still had to make it up ourselves. It was still very much homemade. And not only, again, to show you how fresh-faced we were about it all, not only had we never been in London, not only had we never made a record, we had never met anyone who had made a record, because there was no scene in Glasgow. You know, there was no one before us, anyone that from Glasgow who made records moved to London, and you never met them. So we had there was no mentor, there was no one. It was all done from a distance. It was all through going to see bands playing live. It was all through listening to records, trying to work out what we liked and how you would do it, how you would emulate it, and then how you would eventually create your own thing. And it was all done on the hoof. It was all, whatever you call it now, work, you know, in the work shed. It was just, there was a ton of imagination. That's what there was. There was a ton of enthusiasm, a ton of energy, a ton of imagination.
Well, that must really come into play, you know, as we say, you know, two albums released in that year, which was like the old days, you know, back in the 60s, and there were some bands still doing that, but you know, you follow that up with the album, which released, what, later that year in November.
Yeah.
But that, I mean...
Yeah, well, you were always, by the time an album came out, but, you know, you were always working one ahead. So, for instance, by the time we did our debut album, well, we'd already written all those songs 8, 9, 10 months previously, almost. And then by the time the album came out, you were already playing at sound checks. You would be messing around with new ideas and coming up with stuff. So almost by the time a record came out, it was dated to you. You were already on to the next thing. And especially when there was, you know, three or four of the guys in the band who could come up with ideas, there was no shortage of it. It wasn't like it just hung on one or two songwriters. Everyone was coming up with ideas or you know, the momentum, creative momentum. All we did was play music. If we weren't touring, we would be in a rehearsal room playing night and day. When you do that, you're chock full of ideas.
I was going to say, you know, you talk about that imagination, though. I mean, that must have really come into play with Reel to Reel Cacophony, because that was mostly written in the studio, though, right? I mean, you were still putting songs together.
Yeah, well, usually, I mean, then you were expected to maybe have 10 songs, and perhaps we would have 5 or 6 up our sleeve, and the rest was kind of left to see what would happen in there, which... which I don't advise people to do, but that's the way it was then, yeah. And in our case, it worked out.
Yeah, but that's a really big trust fall, especially coming after, you know, some success right out of the gate on that on Life in a Day, as you kind of mentioned, in that way anyway. But to go in there, I mean, there's a lot of trust. Like, this will come. These songs will happen.
Yeah.
And
you have to believe.
Yeah, and you're still finding your own voice at that point, right? Because, I mean, it's been written. This is a very different record from Life in the Day.
Yeah, I mean, you see, Life in the Day kind of, I don't want to talk it down, but I had this thing by the end of Life in the Day. I mean, as it was coming out the speakers, you know, in one hand, it sounded impressive. We were in there. It was, you know, produced. It sounded great. There it was. But I didn't have, there was something niggling me about it, and I didn't have the experience to know what it was. It wasn't until a week or so after it was finished where I thought, there's more to Simple Minds than this. This is one aspect of Simple Minds. And so with the second album, I think we tried to pour on more of the art rock. And I think I might have overdone it a little bit, because the record company hated it. They really hated it, because they wanted songs like Chelsea Girl, you know, verse chorus, and they, you know, that they're great, but you know, we wanted a bit more Brian Eno in there. And so between that, but even the song, even the album title itself, you know, we're hardly looking for the top 10, but we had to show that the band had a depth that perhaps we felt the first album didn't, and that's the path we went down.
when you're still tweaking the lineup, I mean, going into these, how much of that, you know, did you ever find that that was an issue in any of your records, you know, as the lineup was sort of always in flux in some way?
That came a little bit later on. I mean, that was still very much, Real was still, you know, the original guys that we started out with, really. I mean, actually, we had a few changes before we even made our first album, but Real to Real, the first four albums were, you know, still kind of the band from school, because, you know, Simple Minds was formed, really, from a bunch of school friends. So the first four albums were still around that, and then, you know, you had, like, the drummer saying, this is never going to work. I'm going to go and get married and work in my father-in-law's bar and make money there. And we go, okay.
Have fun. Enjoy.
Yeah.
So, well, that does, you know, kind of lead in. So let's jump 10 years. You know, now we go to 1989, and it is a very different band, once again, with a very different sound. And we're talking about the Street Fightin' years that comes off this one. I mean, would the band from 79 recognize the band from 89, do you think?
That's a good question. No. Probably no.
Probably no. It's a great record, by the way, and I want to compliment that right from the beginning, too, with Street Fightin' Years, because I think it did get lost a bit in the era.
Yeah.
But, it's a very political record, and it is, you all once again kind of toying with your sound, trying to find new things to do. And maybe we just start with the beginning of the year, because you release Mandela Day, which I think had been actually done the year before, but it kind of starts off 89 and leads into the record. I mean, is that the proper kickoff? Because we're just coming off of lots of Mandela talk. We just came out of Russia and the whole world with the Cold War, right. And now the attention was on Africa, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess when we got our big success, you know, really going back to the record before with Once Upon a Time, and we felt, I guess it was just the way we were brought up and stuff. We just felt, also we were growing up, we had much more notice of the world around us, and kind of wanted to write about the themes of the day, you know, that these were our times, we felt, and what a challenge. We were interested in the themes of the day, and you just mentioned some of them. They were the themes that were a big deal to our generation, apartheid, especially in the UK, the whole situation in Northern Ireland, and we wrote Belfast Child about that, and Margaret Thatcher in the UK, there had been a lot of kind of heartless policies that our own town suffered from, so all of that was really fueling the songwriting, which I think, if you're going to make every album like that, I don't know, but I think if you're going to make a lot of, you know, music, and you have a certain wide-eyedness about the world around you, it's inevitable that you're going to write some of the social songs as people who we looked up to did, Peter Gabriel, Bruce Springsteen, so on and so forth. Even Prince with a song like Sign of the Times, you know, just this little 3.5-minute pop song where he manages to pull all the stuff in. It was really something. It was inspiring.
Every single one of these songs are relevant right now. I mean, because here we are again 30 years later in an age of chaos. You know, once again, as I think, you know, one of your lines about that record has been, it's one of the great things about music, but it's one of the unfortunate things about a record like this, I guess, you know?
Well, funny enough, the interview I did just before, the guy asked me, he said, you know, why don't you feel energized to write songs of a political nature just now? And I said, I guess not. And he said, why do you think that is? And I said, I think we wrote them. I think the issues are always the same. The geography maybe changes. Okay, there's no violence in Northern Ireland just now, but the violence is in Syria. Symbolically, a song like Belfast Child can still work, symbolically. Mm-hmm. Or in 1989, when we saw the Berlin Wall come down and all that stuff, I never thought we'd hear about walls again. Guess what?
And here we are.
You're probably tired hearing about them.
Oh. I'm tired of that man speaking at all, for what it's worth.
All right. Black Lives Matter. Well, we wrote about Black Lives Mattering when we wrote about apartheid. It was just a different part of the world. And, I mean, it's sitting just now, it sounds like I'm being smug saying this. I'm not. It's just that I just feel, I said to him, I feel we've wrote those songs. And I think you're right. It's interesting that you point out that the themes are always really the same if you're going to write about the bigger issues. You know, it's always going to be about injustice. So, I mean, new things come in, you know. But even then, we were working with Greenpeace and all that stuff. The whole ecological movement was moving. It just goes on and it travels around the world, the geography.
On the lighter side, you know, Lou Reed guests on this record with This Land, and you know, and that sort of ties back in to Chelsea Girl and on the first record because you know, and you all had that fascination with the Warhol scene. Did that give you access? Were you ever able to kind of dip your toe into Andy's world?
At one point when I was living in London, when I was married to Chrissy Hynde, she was good friends with some of the people that were around that time, Jane County or Wayne County. So there was that, knew David Johansen a bit, but not really. I mean, it was something I felt we grew up with from a distance, but somehow it spoke to us, even though we were teenagers on the other side of the Atlantic.
Well, just to have Lou, you know, kind of be a part of that must have been everything.
Man, come on, it's like getting Picasso, or because you know, to us, that's what he is in musical terms. You know, Lou's, he's a Picasso, and that he would even that we would start this little band. You know, like millions of others inspired by the Velvet Underground. And then, it's funny, I was writing about this last week because I'm in the process of writing a book and I was trying to sum up what it felt like to be in a studio in Paris, me, you know, literally waiting for the man and part terrified because he had a reputation, you know, he could be a bit of a curmudgeon. And, you know, again, feeling completely out of my depth. What do I say to Lou Reed? But, it's amazing to think that it all happened.
I just want to quickly hit on the other two nines real quick. One more of I'll start with a compliment. Our Secrets Are the Same is the great Lost Simple Minds record. It does eventually come out in a box set. You guys started recording that in 99. I mean, the sort of 90s electronica sound that was going on there is so good. This is one of my favorite records, and I'm not just saying that as one of those nerdy fans who pick the obscure record to say that about. But it's like it's the record to me that what could have been had it all, I guess, worked out in a way, you know?
Yeah, I think that's right. It got lost in many ways, the record. We've never been the type to point the finger to blame at other things or whatever, you know, or even with ourselves, the technology was just coming in then. It wasn't quite all there yet, and the new technology was coming in, and we didn't quite really have it down yet. So I feel the production, mixing, and all that could have been a lot better. But yeah, you know, these were the records. You know, by this time, our popularity was well. We were in Alaska. We were, you know, nowhere. But we had to keep it together. We had to go on. We had to move on. We had to keep creating and not turn in on ourselves, regardless as to. Record was dumped. The record company didn't want it. And then we got dumped. They were tough times. But when you look through the history of people, I mean, people much better than us had the same kind of things happen to them, and that's when you find out who you are, and then you go back and you think, you know what, that's a great song, we're going to re-record that soon or whatever. But it does have a charm that I think makes it special.
I mean, you've got a swagger in your vocals that's a really kind of fun to listen to as well on that. I'm a big fan of that one. And then with Graffiti Soul, so that came out in 2009, and that actually has sort of the tie to the present day now, because first off, you know, that was a record, as you say, in, you know, so 1999, there you are on the backside of popularity, but Graffiti Soul puts you back on the charts, and this is a record that's going to get a re-release on Record Store Day, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that was, with Graffiti Soul, we really were starting to show that there was a confidence coming back and a new vitality, and was like, okay, we've stopped flatlining. we gotta get off the table and really show, really stand up and really show that. I always felt if Graffiti Soul had been a brand new band, I think that brand new band would have got a lot of attention.
Right.
Because I think it's that good. So it was the start of what we look on as a process of rehabilitation.
Well, it's kind of fun that it does tie into the present day. So it'll get the re-release. Do you know what comes next at this point? I mean, the newest record is only a year old, so I don't want to jump too far. But as you say, once the record's done, you're already thinking about that next one.
I was walking around Nice this morning thinking about lyrics and listening to some sketches, and we're already turned the ignition on the new one, or what will be the next one. So it goes on.
I cannot wait for that. Do you start to get a feeling as to what it's going to sound like yet?
Yes. Walking around today, I had a real Bob Clearmount and Once Upon a Time feeling about it.
Interesting.
That's just the way it was. Yeah. I just thought, this is evoking for me the kind of joy that was in that record.
Oh, I can't wait for that one. Jim, I'm always such a fan of what you do, and thank you so much for taking this little journey with me today. I so appreciate it.
Appreciate it, Kyle. Thank you very much.
All right. Take care, and we'll be listening.
All the best. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye. Bye-bye. Now, I also talked with Jim Kerr just last year when they were releasing their latest record, Walk Between Worlds. So I'm going to include that here as well. We do talk about bridging his current self to this younger self that we've been talking about in this record. The overwhelming first time that they went to Abbey Road, something that he also mentioned in this interview. There's more of a story about that in the previous interview. So check this one out, too. Part two of Kyle Meredith with Simple Minds.
Hi, Kyle.
Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you.
Really loving this record, Walk Between Worlds.
Oh, great to hear. That's great.
New album, new songs, a progressed sound as you've done throughout your career, although I get from the press release that there's still like this nice trick of sort of having it rooted somewhere in your past, maybe in the artwork, in some of the hooks. Is that correct?
Yeah, Kyle, I think that's it's a perennial challenge. You know, it's kind of Groundhog Day with every album. I think if you were to say, well, you know, what would be the ideal scenario here for fans of the band? Well, it's got to be classic, you know. We want classic Simple Minds, which by the very definition means the past. And then you say, what else you want to go? We want to be contemporary. Well, that means now or the future. What's it going to be? But I guess that you want to tick a few of those boxes and you want to get them to sit nicely with each other. And that's what people are hearing on the album.
And I mean, it is a fun thing for a fan, too, because, you know, to get these new songs, but to have you call back like... I've heard that there's one song where you actually sort of hints at older hooks and things like that.
Yeah, well, that was a song called Sense of Discovery that goes back. In fact, it goes back 6-7 years. There's even a version of it online that I did for a radio session or something. But I always felt sometimes a song has to find its time, and it's hard to define why a song's time is now. It's so many things involved, but it felt it was the right time for this song, and everyone around us, the producer was saying, it's great, leave it, the arrangement is great, and I just kept thinking, well, actually, we're saying it's good, it's really good, it's good, leave it as it is, and I was going, there's a difference between good and great, and I just had this narking feeling that as much as we had a positive reaction, that something was missing, and they would say to me, well, what is it is missing? And I would say, well, kind of like the thing we had on Alive and Kicking, the what you're going to do things. I say, we need something like that. And in the end, we came up with something that I think evokes that. Yeah. And so it's kind of like a postcard from the future back to the past, or maybe the other way around.
Which is awesome. I sort of get that between the title, too, with the title, with Walk Between Worlds. I wondered about that, like... Is that something to do with connecting with your youth through the present?
There is song. I mean, I think the first song on the album, Magic, is it's a young guy talking. It's a young, you know, Neil Young I think he's been modest, but I remember it was a long while ago, he said something about talking about his career, and he says, what you do when you're young doesn't really count, which coming from a because some of the records he made, those young ones, were amazing when he was barely still a kid. I could see the point he was saying. What he was saying is, when you're young, you've nothing else in your life. Some might say you've got nothing to lose. You get energy, you burn, you stay up all night. You're not, you know, you're 100% engaged. And that's what a lot of great work comes out of. However, Neil was saying, fast forward 20, 30 years, when you've been round a bit, you've had a few knocks, you've experienced, you've had other things in your life, relationships, and don't get me wrong, my life has been, by and large, been great, but you know, no one gets a completely free ride. So to go back to your work when you're in that state is quite interesting what can come out. In our album, the first song, Magic, is the young guy, and the last song, Sense, Discovery, is someone with a lot more experience than, and they're both talking about faith, which is kind of abstract if you take it outside of the religious sense. But, you know, the young guy's talking about the faith to believe he's got this thing in him and he wants to get it out to the world. He believes in magic. He believes everything is possible, all that stuff. And I certainly did when I was younger. The older guy is a bit more tempered. He's still with them, but he's a bit more tempered. And that seems to be the scope of some of the songs.
I mean, when you've got that much to look back on, you know, 40 years, which you guys just celebrated last year, it's interesting to have that foresight and the hindsight and everything that goes into the writing here. It's a cool concept. I'm really enjoying it.
Thank you.
And as far as the sound of the record, I also see, I read that you've sort of laid it out, you know, in the album since, that side one has a sound and side two sort of has a different sound. Is that right?
I would say more, it's more a structure of the songs where we, you know, when it comes towards the end of recording and you've got this, you know, you're shuffling the deck and you're, it's hard now because we were brought up a generation where we're brought up with vinyl and there was two sides and you structured your songs. Now it's quite hard to know how anyone listens to music because everyone listens to it differently and it's all a bit more sliced and diced now. People make their own playlists, but nevertheless, before it leaves us, we have to come up with what we think's a definitive song listing and something that we think gives a narrative in its best way. And when we were doing it, it seemed to us that there was two categories. What turns out to be the first, you know, half the songs there, four or five songs there, the sprightly, young, poppy, very much poppy style songs, very compact, concise arrangements. In the old day, you might have said radio arrangement. And they're very much like that. Whereas the second group of songs, some of them lasting 5, 6, even 7 minutes, much more expansive in concept, expansive in sound. The widescreen sound of Simple Minds, blah de blah. But it definitely felt there was a couple of distinct natures of the beast there.
And these strings at Abbey Road, had you ever recorded there before this?
Well, it's a very funny story because we in our debut album, Life in the Day, we worked with, he's a great producer very much at that time, a guy called John Leckie, who himself had come up through Abbey Road. He cut his teeth engineering and those Pink Floyd records and some of the Beatles things and all that. And John, in his wisdom then, it was in his wisdom, on our first album, thought it would be great to us to come down from Glasgow to London. Had never been in London almost. And I don't think it was a week, but we had 5 days in 1979. We'd never made an album. There we were on Abbey Road and that famous room. And the interesting thing was half the band were so inspired by that. And you could understand that. However, the other half, including yours truly, we shrunk because the magnitude of it was, what does anyone need us for? You know, if everywhere you look around, every tambourine, every mellotron's been used by Pink Floyd and the Beatles, and who the hell needs a record from us, which was my thought. So I didn't enjoy it first time round. This time round, it was great, you know, because, yeah, I had the measure of it. And and you were getting into this temple, and it is a temple, and this music temple, and working with these, you know, musicians that are from a different world and from a different source of reference and all that, but very enriching, really great.
I mean, like, I always sort of wonder that about how it is. Like you know, I've never been there. I've never been over there. And, you know, it's so it still has all that mystique for me. And I sort of wonder when you're more local, you know, when you're in the UK,
it still
holds that weight. And the sound of it does.
Oh, definitely. Oh, yeah. I mean, that zebra crossing is outside it. And as I say, it was more to do with the nature of the people involved. I remember our bass player, he was like, "Isn't this a greatest thing ever?" I was like, "No." It's like, what are we doing here? We'd hardly, you know, I was, up until then, the only time I'd been to London, I was hitchhiking. So, I mean, it was something.
And so you're going to take this out on the road. You're performing the album in full. And I've got to say, that puts a lot of faith in the new work to say, we believe in this thing so much, you're going to hear it from front to back.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's quite a nice turn of events because, let's say, bands of our vintage, more often you get, oh, you're not going to play new stuff, are you? You're only going to play some new stuff, aren't you? Because that's the way of the world. And however, when we handed this over, couldn't believe it. Record company, everyone said, you've got to play this whole thing. It's going to be great. And they had more faith in it than me. They said, you've got to play, you know, you're going to play this. And I said, yeah, we'll play a few songs. No, you're going to play it, surely. It's 8 songs. You can do it. And I mean, the structure, we're doing it, it's only 8 or 9 gigs. And the old days, they were called a showcase, and you would have gone around. But yeah, we're going to play it, and we're going to do a bit of talking about it. And last year, we did a tour of our acoustic. We did acoustic versions of our catalogue. And we ended up doing more talking than we thought we would do. And not only that, it got a great reaction because, well, there's things to talk about now. And people kind of like it, especially if you can get the right mix of humility and seriousness and humor and be spontaneous and all that as well. And so we're going to do a bit of some question answer stuff as well, play the stuff, but also, you know, of course, we'll start the set and we'll end the set with some songs from back in the day.
Well, I'm envious. I love this record enough too that I would love to see it front to back. So, you know, maybe there'll be a video document of it or something like that. It's you've really outdone yourself.
Ah, good man. Well, there is. One of the shows is getting filmed and it'll be up on YouTube.
Oh, fantastic! Well, I look forward to it, Jim. It was so great talking to you.
Pleasure. Thanks for the encouragement. Bye bye.
All right. Take care. Bye.
My thanks to Jim Kerr of Simple Minds for a nice 40-year quest. Hey, if you haven't already, please do hit that subscribe button. And again, you can keep up with us on YouTube or Spotify, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Acast, or Podchaser, wherever you get your podcasts from. After that, head over to WFPK.org. That's where I do a show every Monday through Thursday from noon to 3 Eastern. You can also find some bonus episodes of this series over there. ConsequenceOfSound.net. They've got all your music and film news needs. You can find me at Twitter at Kyle Meredith, Facebook.com/KyleMeredith. That does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offer, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM, make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-ALL for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.